ऐसी मशीन लगाऊंगा, इस साइड से आलू बनेगा, उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Hello everyone, welcome to this episode of the Attention Please podcast. So this seems to be yet another episode where it'll just be me. So I'll try to make the best of the time that we have. So the first thing that I wanted to talk about today is Ramdev versus the Indian Medical Association, or the IMA. Now this is again one of those battles that I cannot fully empathize with any one side, with any one of the combatants, because I think they're both fundamentally flawed. First of all, Ramdev. Now, Baba Ramdev has been a lightning rod for India's progressive left, and for very good reason. He wears saffron, he's unapologetically Hindu, and in a way he represents to left liberal Indians what a success should not be. And yet, Baba Ramdev is unapologetically successful. My personal experience in terms of his, he produces good products which are competitively priced. He's launched a business empire in the FMCG space. So as a businessman, there is a lot to respect about Baba Ramdev. He's I would say the Dhirubhai Ambani of our times. So in terms of, and he started off small, he popularized yoga, he took something which was ancient, then he used that to build his own personal brand, and he has now expanded, selling pretty much everything, including jeans. And backing his brand is that buy Indian Swadeshi angle. And by doing that, by buying Ramdev products, you're not just buying a product, you're also showing your middle finger to the enemies of India. So it's always good when you're able to make that kind of a connect with your brand to your customers. So again, in terms of the messaging, in terms of his own personal brand building, I definitely admire Baba Ramdev. And I think that he gets a lot of hatred because he's been successful when as part of the narrative he shouldn't have been, but he has been. But again, as part of any empire, and again, it's a valid criticisms. There are many valid criticisms of Baba Ramdev, which I agree with. First of all, his well-documented stance against same-sex relations, his characterization of same-sex love as a disease that he can cure through yoga. He's gone on record saying that. And I would say also his association with the current government. Now, again, I would say that given India's still very strong culture of Babudom and the state not getting out of the path of private enterprise, it is virtually impossible for any self-made entrepreneur at the scale at which Baba Ramdev operates not to be not to have friends in high places. So every big business house that has flourished in India has had that. So kind of singling out Baba Ramdev as being close to the ruling party is again a part of that lightning rod aspect of him, in the sense that he is picked on many times because if Baba Ramdev was somebody who wore a suit, had a tie, was clean shaven, and kind of met the visual stereotype of a captain of industry, I think he would have had lot less attention. Now, I think he would also have had lot less success. Like Lalu Yadav, Baba Ramdev knows that visual stereotype that he very consciously complies with, he wants to be like that, is also the source of his greatest strength and also the source of the kind of adulation and devotees that he has, which allows him many times to push his products without having the clinical evidence behind it. And so, again, there's never, the world is made of grays. And there's no doubt that Baba Ramdev is somebody who is in that gray zone. He's, and I think that's true of anybody who's successful that fast and that much. So there's nothing special about him in that way. And one of the things that he does, and again, this comes to the current controversy, is that he throws, you know, he kind of panders to his base, like anybody who wants to have a band of devotees. And that's where centrists like me lose out, because there's, by trying to be rational, you can never, I mean, it's almost, it runs counter to pandering if you are being objective, which means that you go by the science and you go by the facts. So you don't say something just because your audience wants you to say it. But Ramdev, like anybody who's smart, does that. So what he does is, and this is not the first time he's done it, so he panders to the tropes against allopathy. Again, there's nothing called allopathy. It's a term coined by homeopathy, basically evidence-based Western medicine. And he, what he does is he turns people's very well-documented and often well-justified rage against doctors and the hospital system into a rage against conventional evidence-based medicine. And most of us who have been exposed to doctors, be it in India or, as in my case, both India as well as the US, we normally don't walk away with a very good experience with doctors and the healthcare system. We always feel we have been overcharged. We always feel that the doctors don't listen to us. We always feel that we were our concerns were ignored, more or less. So I doubt there's anybody who can say that they have consistently had a great experience dealing with healthcare. Now, which is why there is always rage. And healthcare is expensive. That's also true. I mean, this is not something which I'm hearing today. When I was growing up in Calcutta, pretty much, and those days people didn't have political discussions in weddings and in family occasions, but they definitely had medical discussions. And this was a persistent theme, the persistent theme that allopathy is terrible, that the pharma companies are all in it, that everything is a conspiracy, and that good old-fashioned medicine would have solved everything. Or, you know, not just good old-fashioned medicine. It was not always an endorsement of homeopathy or Ayurveda, but, you know, doctors of old, like there was these stories which again might be, which might not be fully true. There was no alt news at that point of time, fact-checking when people talked. But, you know, stories like, you know, Dr. Bidhan Chandra Rai, who when somebody would walk in to his room, he would look at them and say, oh, you've got, you know, a kidney disease. You know, he didn't need to do any tests. And all these tests are all fraudulent and the doctors are in collusion with these labs. You don't actually need all of those tests at all. You can just say by looking at the person what problem they had or by like touching their stomach. So, of course, a lot of this comes from anger at being made to pay for these tests. And many times our experience with doctors, it doesn't also end very well. It ends with perhaps death. And so at the end, you see, you know, somebody died and then we spent our life savings. And that kind of comes out against doctors in general. And I think any doctors listening to this would immediately recognize, I empathize with doctors too. I empathize with the fact that there are many things that they can't do. And I fully understand that medical research costs money, which is why drugs cost money. I also understand that healthcare is a business, that we cannot go by the doctor's ne fees mangi hai, that only works in Hindi movies. But it's also undeniable that there is a significant group of people who hate doctors. And so when Ramdev throws this kind of narrative out, he's basically throwing, you know, red meat to his base, or in this case, not red meat, I would say red carrots, because, you know, his base doesn't have eat meat. Anyways, I'm sorry for that joke. Anyways, so the with the current crisis, it's been with respect to Coronil. And what complicates the problem is that Coronil and Ramdev are one of the major sponsors of 24/7 news, which means it's virtually impossible to have any kind of objective reporting about him and his products. So given all of that, that's where the gray part of it comes. I personally feel that his comments against allopathy at this point of time, when we are in the middle, I mean, normally 2 years ago, this wouldn't have, it's okay, it's fine. This is just part of his brand. So those who will believe this are in any case going to believe it. And those who know about evidence-based medicine are in any case going to trust their lives with it, they can ignore it. But in this situation, the kind of once in a generation or once in a 100 years crisis that we are, the fact is he's an influencer. It's not one Uncle G sitting and like writing something in WhatsApp and sending it to someone. He's definitely an influencer and a very, very influential person, especially among people at the age group that is most susceptible to coronavirus. And so for him to then attack the very basis, why very obviously at the same point of time, this is an endorsement for his product Coronil, which doesn't have, to be honest. And then some of his questions are so juvenile, the kind of questions he raised. In one of the open questions he sent to the IMA was, if allopathy is so good, why do doctors die? Or something like that. Or why are doctors getting COVID? And he said that publicly. So many doctors are getting COVID. So many doctors are getting COVID even after being vaccinated twice. And that's objectively false. Very few have as a percentage after getting two doses of the vaccine. And this is the kind of coming from an influencer which promotes vaccine hesitancy. And as it is, it's terrible. As it is, there are many people who do not believe in these things, who are scared of these things. And again, for somebody like Ramdev, who's trusted, and I would say he's earned the trust in many respects, because he has provided good health advice when it comes to yoga. He's definitely popularized it. I will say that many of his products are actually good. So there is a goodwill that he genuinely has. And some of it is, of course, his brand building, and any smart person would do both. They would have a good product, but they would also do a lot of brand building. And there's nothing fundamentally wrong about that in capitalism. But the fact is, there's also the notion of overall good. And what he's done in this case is terrible, in the sense that he is, at this point of time, he should be using his position, because this is we are living in very special times. And attacking Western medicine, attacking it. And again, his attacks, and one always welcomes skepticism, but his attacks are also so, for the want of a better word, juvenile. I mean, if it's a science-based attack, it's fine. And his question was, what about Remdesivir? You guys first said it, then you said it. No, what about quinine? What about all of these things? But you're basically making the other side's point. That's the thing about evidence-based medicine, is that evidence-based medicine doesn't say that there's a solution. It says, here's a solution. Let's do a study. And this is being done while there's a crisis going on. And if there is some hope, then people say, let's do it, as long as it's not causing any harm. And if the person's in any case going to die, then why not try this? Why not try Remdesivir at that point of time? And then that, as we do this, we collect more and more data. And we see that overall, it is not efficacious. It does not lead to any significant increase that maybe justifies whatever risks there is for the treatment. And that's really the basis of what evidence-based medicine is. It's not that whenever you put anything in your body, it has some side effects. Even the food that you eat has side effects. So the whole objective of evidence-based medicine is risk management, is to see whether the benefit that is provided by consuming this concoction of chemicals outweighs the bad effect of that. So to say, oh, medicines have bad effects, yes, of course they do. That's why we continuously monitor efficacy data at any point of time when those in the know feel that the risk of the use outweighs the benefit at that point of time that is no longer considered to be medication for that ailment. That is precisely the point of evidence-based medicine. So what Ramdev is attacking in terms of allopathy isn't really allopathy. It's anything which should be, he's attacking science. So even with respect to Ayurvedic treatment, that also needs to stand exactly that test of science. For me, that is the most important thing. That is, I'm not saying that the Western science knows everything. I mean, ultimately, Western science and Eastern science, they're both using the same elements that are found in nature. The main thing is it doesn't matter who's making what. It matters as to what the data of clinical efficacy is. And everybody needs to, there needs to be a level playing field. Everybody needs to go through the exact same standards. And if it is Coronil that makes that standard, great. But it hasn't. It hasn't been able to make that standard. So rather than accepting that, attacking the very standard is problematic, because it's very problematic in this case. You can say, well, that's what a businessman would do. But at this point of time, it's not just about business. There are lives at stake. There is overall vaccine hesitancy. And it's not a question of just hesitancy in the way that we see in the US, where there are just some people who just want, because of their religious beliefs, they will not go and take vaccines, or because they follow the, you know, they have the strange, bizarre ideas. In India, this is not, and I think many of them also understand fundamentally that what they're doing is wrong. It's just that they feel that we won't give the Democrats that pleasure. So it's like they hate the Democrats even more than they love themselves sometimes. But in India, there is genuine puzzlement about many of these things. And again, I'll come back to the fact that Ramdev, because of his reach and influence, and there's very good reasons why he has that, very valid reasons why he has that. It isn't because what the left liberal media says, it's all he's because, you know, because he's manipulated the media. No, he's produced a good product for years now. And that's why he has that connection with his customers. So, but this is not the time for business development. This is not the time for image development. Now, this is Ramdev on one side. The other side is the Indian Medical Association. Now, Indian Medical Association, just like, and by the way, it was one thing that, you know, by doing this, I think Baba Ramdev actually does a great disservice to Indian classical therapies, because what he does is he makes it very, very easy for many people who, based on essentially programming in their head based on their education, who likes to think that anything that has been done in India is fundamentally flawed and fundamentally backward. And this happens when we have been educated for hundreds of years based on stuff written by colonizers. That's really the basis of colonialism, is that it's not just a question of conquering land, it's conquering minds. It's making the ruled feel that they are inferior, inferior human beings, inferior in terms of culture. And it'll take hundreds of years for us to perhaps come out of this. So there is entrenched belief in many people that Eastern medicine and Eastern science is just doesn't stand up to the rigors of what Western medicine is. And by making these kinds of statements, I think Baba Ramdev allows people to say that. He becomes associated with this, with the hundreds of years and thousands of years of tradition that he represents, and they're not the same. It's important to note that they're not the same. That he's an imperfect ambassador for classical Indian medicine. And again, whether the source is classical Indian or whether it's Western, nowadays, what's Indian, what's Western? The thing is, anything, in order for it to be considered to be a valid treatment, has to pass through the test of science. It doesn't matter who made it, where it was made, what goes into it. It needs to demonstrate that given in a control study where some people are given the drug and they don't know they've been given the drug, and some people are given the drug, that the people who are knowingly given the drug, so two groups, the control group, and which doesn't get the drug, there's a group which gets the drug, and then you statistically show that the people who got the drug did better than those that didn't get the drug. So that means that the thing that led to the people doing well, that group, was the drug. That's why you have the controlled population. It's not that they would have in any case gotten better. So until and unless you can make, you can satisfy this condition, it doesn't matter where your therapy is coming from, whether it's a 1,000-year-old therapy or it was made like 1,000 hours ago, but it has to satisfy this. And I think that, but I kind of got distracted coming back to IMA. So this is, again, a fundamentally flawed organization, which, again, does not represent evidence-based medicine at all. I mean, this is an organization which, you know, has endorsed Pepsi fruit juices in the past, you know, which pretty much are responsible for like sugared juices. We're responsible, one of them were the single biggest factors for childhood obesity. It's only in India, I would think. I mean, I can't believe any American Medical Association endorsing a Pepsi fruit drink, you know, basically raw sugar in water. That's it. That's what it is. Like really sugar jacked up. So you really love it with some, you know, flavoring added to make it, you know, give it the apple taste. There's no real apple, very little apple in it. So, and again, even with apple, it's just, if you have, I mean, it's ultimately it's carbs. So it's like full of carbs. And in a country which has a diabetes epidemic, to endorse at something like this, it just blows my mind. And the fact that they can get away with this is because they do not get the amount of scrutiny that a Ramdev would get. If Ramdev gets, does something like this, and he does get criticized. Maybe not in the media outlets where he runs a lot of advertisements, but in other places he does. But the IMA gets very little attention because they have that umbrella of being rational. And if you look at I was reading the interview, which, you know, this very controversial interview, with John Rose Austin Jayalal, who's the president of the Indian Medical Association, has given to a website called Christianity Today. Now, I will provide the link, but if anybody in India in charge of any scientific organization had given these kind of statements, then there would be a lot more. I was following which news outlets have reported this. So it's Op India, Swarajya, Organizer. It's none of the traditional, you know, First Post has one article. But none of the traditional news media organizations have reported this. This is explosive. Like, the, you know, on one hand, you're having this controversy over Western medicine, evidence-based medicine. And what is the person who apparently claims to be speaking for evidence-based medicine? And this is the problem with IMA, that if this is the person you're going to be leading with, then you cannot then take the moral high ground. The headline of the piece that I'm looking at is, an Indian Christian doctor sees COVID-19 silver linings. And if that sounds extremely insensitive, you can say, well, in any case, it's he didn't give the headline. But then you have to read what the interview is, and man, that interview is something, I would say. And some of the, I mean, without getting into the even more controversial parts, which are, I would say, grossly non-secular, there's a lot of stuff that he said which actually has no evidence either. Like, for instance, there's a question which says, what do you make of the disparity between the West and India with respect to the severity of COVID-19? Now, this is happening before the outbreak. So when he says, in India, we're exposed to so many types of bacteria, and so our immunity has been built up. Our people who live in rural areas are exposed to all types of unsanitized water and environmental problems. But most of the time in the UK and US, you're not exposed to those kinds of bacteria and viruses. You have a protected environment and the resistance power is less with you. So when you're exposed to it, you're more likely to succumb to it. This has absolutely no scientific evidence behind it. And this is the president of the IMA who's saying it. This is no different than anything that Baba Ramdev has said. And again, this, and how do I know it's wrong? Well, do I need to tell you why it's wrong? I'll go more. He talks about BCG vaccination. He said the third reason is that one of the vaccinations that we have used is an anti-tuberculosis called a BCG vaccination. Did that work? Was there any scientific evidence behind that? No, there wasn't. He said it. And then, of course, he has a line which says, I personally feel God must have been distracted with the US and now he's focusing on India and he's having some grace on us in India. So we want to proclaim the message that it is the grace of God. And it is not by our power, not by our might, but by the grace of God, along with the good healthcare delivery system, that we are getting that positive response. And this person's organization is representing evidence-based medicine. So there's this overall irony all around, which would be hilarious if it were not so, if it was not these times, that these are the two guys who are fighting. They're actually not very different at all. None of them actually believe, seems to believe in science. But the fact is, because of the politics, that one side is considered to be much more legitimate than the other. Now, again, the issue here, rather than Ramdev versus IMA, is one of science versus pseudoscience. Whether it be the efficacy of Ayurvedic treatments for coronavirus, or whether it be hypothesis like the fact that Indians have BCG vaccine we are just used to living in filth, that's why we don't get COVID. You know, that is the problem. The problem is assertions made by people in positions of influence and authority that do not have scientific basis. That is the problem. The fact that you have doctors, an organization ostensibly of doctors endorsing sugary drinks in a country which has a diabetes epidemic and increasing instances of childhood obesity. That is the problem. It's not, unfortunately, we see it in terms of Ramdev versus IMA. We see it in terms of a guy wearing saffron robes versus a guy who is basically an evangelical Christian. But that is not the problem. That is a sidelight. The main problem is one of science. It is the fact that we should be convinced, we should have data before we put anything into our bodies. And it doesn't matter where that thing comes from. That ultimately we as non-medical professionals do not know. So that's why we delegate that responsibility to the government, to authorities, to do that assessment for us, to tell us whether the risks of this medicine, and risks are both in terms of the bad effects it causes to the body, as well as the cost that you pay for it in terms of, you know, your rupees and paisa. So is the risk worth it? Is what it takes out of you versus what it puts into you, are they well balanced? And that is the point. It's not a question of Ramdev. It's not a question of IMA. Again, just like Ramdev has made some, you know, questionable statements, does not take away his achievements and the reasons why he demands and should get respect. It's the same thing with the IMA. Just because they have one member making flawed statements, or they have done some, you know, questionable brand endorsements in the past, does not mean that what their doctors are doing or what everybody is saying in the IMA is terrible. That's absolutely not true. The problem is, in this time and age, is who is standing with science and who's not standing with science. I think that is the main problem. Moving on to the next topic for today is the Twitter versus the Indian government. So there's a lot that has been said about this. And the first thing that I want to say is, if the current government is actually serious about privacy, which I hear Ravi Shankar Prasad saying, oh, we have every right to be, you know, yeah, sure you do. But hey, wait, hold on. If you're sure about privacy, then where is a severe data privacy law like a GDPR? Where is that? Where is a law which provides Indian citizens the right to their data, the right to know how their data is being used by commercial organizations, the right to regulate what happens to their data, the right to tell commercial entities that we do not want our data with you, we do not want you to sell our data, we want you to the right to forget, as they say, and the right to punitive damages in case of data breaches where it is proved that best security practices have not been followed. Where is that law? If the government is sincere about data privacy, if it is sincere about transitioning India to a digital economy, then where is that law? Where is that legal infrastructure for doing that? The government has been in power for a long time. E-commerce is not new. Where is a law with teeth? We know why the law isn't there. I will tell you why the law isn't there, because the government doesn't want to come under that law. What would have happened to Air India, which recently I found out has compromised about 10 years of your data? What would happen to many of the governmental organizations to which you have to provide data? Will they also come under the purview of this law? So if the government is concerned about the privacy of its citizens, well, kudos to them. But there's a lot of things that they haven't done. And this, what is currently going on, is a totally different thing. It has got nothing to do with data privacy. So for me, I don't think any government, whether it be BJP or Congress, they don't want to get into data privacy because they don't want to tie themselves up in chains. That's the problem. But we do need very strong data privacy laws. We absolutely need data privacy laws, and there are great predicate laws that we can follow. Now, the question over here, before we get to the question, there's another question, which is about WhatsApp and end-to-end encryption. So this is a conundrum that's as old as the hills. So this started when initially decades ago, when the first encryption algorithms like AES were being developed. So there was a school that said that whether RSA or AES, that there should be backdoors that the US government, nobody else, should be allowed to have because of law enforcement, because of course the bad guys are going to use it. So all of this is good, but what if the bad guys use it? Now, that was strongly repulsed at that point of time with exactly this logic, that by ceding first of all, there's no trust. There's no global universal trust in the US government for them to do the right thing. And I think that history shows why. It's not it's not unfounded why not just the US citizens, but nobody trusts the US government. That's one thing. And second thing is, whenever you create any system with known seeded vulnerabilities, no matter the greatness of your intent, you can be 100% sure that those vulnerabilities will be found out and will be exploited. And then it will be terrible for all of us. So if there are vulnerabilities seeded into encryption algorithms, trust me, there would be people who would find it. And then any electronic transaction that we do would be at risk. So this is that is absolutely imperative that backdoors and vulnerabilities are not seeded intentionally. I mean, unintentional tough stuff happens. That's okay. That's one thing. But intentionally, if people know, then trust me, that knowledge will become public knowledge very soon. And so what WhatsApp and what we should insist on in any messaging that we use is end-to-end encryption, which what that means is that our conversations are encrypted. Only the sender and receiver can see it, not the intermediate organization. WhatsApp cannot see your message with end-to-end encryption. And WhatsApp does not store. So each of these conversations that you have, they are done using short-lived keys, which are renegotiated in the next transaction. So once those keys are gone, nobody can basically go back and read them. So that's really the underlying principle of the signal algorithm that it uses, which is based on something called double ratchet. So this is very important. This ephemerality of keys is very, very important. And any kind of backdoor seeded into the scheme just means that it's not the government. If you're the kind of person who intrinsically believes in the government to do good, even if we buy that, why should I care about privacy? I have nothing to hide. The fact is once you start doing this, it will be found out by the bad guys and whoever you want to define as the bad guys. So again, the Indian, I've seen some news articles, and obviously, you know, you'll find that the government spokespersons, they will either they don't understand this or they willfully, they'll say, oh, but, you know, WhatsApp has metadata. It knows who sent who at what time, but they don't know what's inside it. It's the same kind of technically metadata that your telephone companies have. When you get your bill, when you said you called this person at this point of time, that's the information that they have. They're not recording your call as to what's going on in your call. Now, they can. That's why telephone calls are fundamentally insecure, because there's nothing that prevents them from doing it technologically. They're basically the goodness of their heart. But in WhatsApp, that's really what secure messaging is, that even if the service provider, whether it be WhatsApp or Signal, you know, even if they are compromised, even if you don't trust them, end-to-end encryption means ultimately that it's me and that person who I'm sending it to. Everybody else is not trusted. So it's very important that nothing in the algorithms be compromised. And this is important. I mean, don't let governments, under the rules of national security, try to make a case that it should be done. This is not new. They have another US government. The US government has tried this before. And guess what? It's been 30, 40 years of encryption. And there's never been a nuclear bomb that's about to go off unless we have a backdoor into, you know, the RSA scheme. That's never really happened. But because of that, we do net banking. Because of that, we buy expensive stuff online. So at that point of time, this was exactly the argument that was made. Which brings me now to the core of the problem. And this is not a problem that has an easy solution. This is a problem that is being fought in virtually every country. So the thing is an organization like Twitter or Facebook responsible for the content that users generate on it? So initially, when websites and when blogs and, you know, any website which had comments, when it came up, they basically worked with the US government at that point of time to make themselves legally not liable for content that was put on their websites. So they said, look, we just merely provide a tabula rasa, you know, kind of a blank slate. And the person who's putting the content is responsible for the content. Now, initially, when things were simple, when everybody had IP addresses, there was no Tor, there was, you know, people could be traced. Things were much more simple. The number of websites, the number of users were, I would say, manageable. This kind of made sense. There was some expectation that speech would ultimately be traced to the origin of whoever was making it. But as the net expanded, as the scope of interactions became, and the popular word is internet scale, and as Twitter and Facebook got an up, you know, kind of revolutionized this space, sooner or later, governments began to take the stance that no, social media companies can't just raise their hands and say, we're not responsible for the content that is being carried. So this movement started, again, as it starts when liberals don't get the results that they wanted. This started when Hillary Clinton lost to Donald Trump. So it was then that, you know, Facebook's stance was, look, you know, this is, you know, kind of the way we have worked. So if, you know, Russian bots are putting out fake news about, you know, Hillary Clinton, you know, eating babies for lunch, we know that it's, you know, fake. That's pretty obvious. Any, you know, half intelligent person would immediately say it's fake. But we can't do anything, because, you know what? The moment we start censoring speech, we kind of go down that slippery slope, at which point of time we become responsible for the content. Now we're responsible for policing the content. Now then, of course, after this, the mood shifted, and everybody said that the liberals in the US said that, you know why Trump won this election? Because of friggin' Facebook. They won because Facebook, because it's not so much Twitter, but because of Facebook. So then the trend changed globally. That's, you know, it was considered important that the social media organizations, they regulate speech. So they were said that, no, you have to do something to control fake news. You will, and this was again repeatedly, Zuckerberg was called to Congress and, you know, he was attacked by Ocasio-Cortez that, you know, if I take a fake ad out, knowing fully well that it is fake, will Facebook run it? And at that point of time, the, of course, the commercial reason that Facebook was, Facebook doesn't want to turn away any ads. Simple as that. So what makes it even more complicated is the total conflict of interest. Again, when the internet started and when you had, like, when you had my blog and you had my comments, there was no commercial reason why I would let somebody, you know, have their comments there and moderate other people's comments. But now with political parties paying these social media organizations directly or indirectly, there is now a conflict of interest. Either you say that, you know, I'm not going to take anything down, or if you are going to be editorializing, then there is a notion of, well, if I pay you enough, you will basically do at my bidding. So this is now putting an enormous amount of power, and that's exactly what's happened. And this is what happened when Trump and during the January 6th insurrection here. So at that point of time, Twitter decided to ban Trump, which was really what, which was both Facebook, which was really where the problem started with. This was really what the US liberals were driving at. So when they said that they wanted Facebook to in accountability, it was basically an euphemism for we want you to ban Trump. Because they realized that the reason why, you know, Trump is so insanely popular is because he has that social media platform. That's the real thing about Indrajit in this case. And so it's important that you take that away. And Facebook, of course, you know, it's in a corporation, so it wants to play both sides. They took it away after Trump lost the election. So they didn't do it before because they were afraid. I mean, then if Trump comes back, then of course there'd be hell to pay for that. So they took it after Trump was, you know, they realized, yeah, now Trump is expendable. So let's now take his Twitter back. He was still technically the president, so they couldn't say that. You couldn't say that they didn't do it to President Trump. So they did what I call the whole Narasimha Prahlad move. That, you know, if you remember, I will neither kill you in the morning, nor will I kill you in the evening. I will neither kill you down, nor will I kill you up. So I'll kill you on the stairs at the time of twilight, essentially. It's when you don't read the terms and conditions and they get you. So this is exactly what they did to Trump. Now, in India, we are basically having, and after that, in this case, they are tagging, and this is exactly what happened with Trump during this elections, that they started tagging Trump's tweets with saying, this is disputed information, or this is basically fake news. And this is exactly what Trump's opponents had been wanting Twitter to do. I mean, when they say again, when we say that we want you to editorialize, they wouldn't like it if it was turned back on them. If they started doing that to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, then they would say, oh, these people have taken money from the Republicans, that's why they're doing it to us. So this basically means that please censor speech that we do not like. Again, the question here isn't freedom of speech, because technically freedom of speech is something, is a contract between you and the government. So this is a private organization. So they always have that escape clause that, look, this is a private place. We are a private company. The fact that you have an account here is not a democratic right that is guaranteed by citizenship. It's a privilege. You get it for free. You don't even pay for it. So yeah, if you're free in a place, then yes, you need to accept some rules at the very least. And again, if you were paying for it, like let's say a LinkedIn paid account, well, if you don't like the way we do things, you can take your business elsewhere. So right now with Twitter, the frustration of the government is exactly that. Because Twitter in India is, again, because of the political stance, of Twitter, of its employees, that they are, and they have been given the right to editorialize. So you can't say, why are you doing it? In an ideal world, they wouldn't have. They would have said, you know what, and the government, when I say the Indian government, has asked
social media companies to regulate speech, which they have felt is, so they have given them the power to do this editorializing. Now, the moment you give this power, they're not going to use it just for your benefit, for the government's benefit. You've given them the power. Now that they have the power, they're going to use it in the way that they want. And I know that there is no good solution for this. It's not like you can say, you know, you can post, you know, there's a lot of things which the Twitter should be held accountable for if they are hosting that content. For instance, you know, child pornography. You can't just wash your hands and say, I did just a blank slate. And if somebody puts it there, they put it there. No, of course not. Of course not. You have to take it down. You have to cooperate with the law enforcement. You have to make sure that these people are prosecuted. So there are definitely some lines that everybody knows does not constitute free speech. All of us know that. So it's, again, sometimes there's this false argument put. No, this is a false argument. Everybody knows. I think nobody will say that, nobody at that point of view will either say freedom of speech or, you know, unnecessary censorship or political bias. Nobody will say that. So that thing is always there. It's always been there. What people are talking about is free speech. And again, for me, I strongly believe that other than these very extreme cases, which I don't think there's any dispute about, social media companies should not be tagging items, especially, and this is very important with respect to what was tagged, with respect to what Trump was saying, many of those things were objectively untrue. They were objectively untrue, and it was 100% evident that they were lies. In the case of what they did to essentially what Sambit Patel did, this was an under investigation case. In what basis does Twitter, other than their belief that I would say that BJP manipulated this media, other than a belief, but again, this is where the persons running Twitter come up rather than Twitter as an organization. By under what evidence have they concluded before the courts that this is manipulated media? That is definitely something which Twitter has to answer to. If you've been given the right to editorialize, so you have the right to editorialize. I guess it has been given to you. But when you have the right to editorialize, you have to provide under a legal challenge under what circumstances you took that decision. The fact that you're a private organization in this case, and you know, you can come back with, I'm a private organization, I can do what I like. Now, that's when countries have to say, no, you cannot do as you like. You're a private organization. And just as you provide the privilege of people to have accounts, we as a country provide you the privilege to have people of citizens of our country as your users. So this notion of giving people privilege goes both ways. So no, you do us a favor in terms of citizens. Of course, you sell our data as a result of that. We all know it. That's a bargain which we make when we sign up for one of these social media accounts, that we don't pay any money, but we pay through our behavior, in the sense that you track us, you know what we buy, you know what we say, and we're perfectly fine with that. If you're not, then yeah, you'd stay off social media. That's a bargain. It's just like we make a bargain. You also make a bargain with the government of our country when you choose to operate it within its borders. So yeah, you definitely cannot be above the law, which Twitter feels that it is. Because ultimately they're an organization run in a Western country, that the standards don't apply. The kind of, think of it. If the US government subpoenas Mark Zuckerberg, Mark Zuckerberg will come. If the Indian parliament subpoenas Mark Zuckerberg, we guaranteed he won't come. And why is that the case? You can say, well, Facebook is a US company. Well, it's a US company on a technicality. It operates globally. There's no distinction between an Indian citizen. I mean, it operates, okay, if it operates globally, what about Indian citizens in the US? What about their rights? So in this day and age, Facebook can't have it both ways. And I say Facebook, Facebook, Twitter can't have it both ways. Either they're accountable to the governments of all countries in which they operate in, or they're accountable to no one. Or they say, look, the internet is a non-national entity. We don't exist in any country. We exist virtually on the internet. So we are not under the jurisdiction of any laws. We are a country by ourselves. They don't say that in the US because they know they can't. None of them can say that. They like to believe so. So what they kind of end up looking like is essentially that same old Western, one standard for rich countries and one standard for poor countries. So for the rich countries, yep, we will go there and we will explain our stance. For the poor countries, hey, understand what freedom of speech means. Now, I'm not saying that this government, and again, any government in India cares for freedom of speech or it cares. No, it's concerned about criticism of itself. I'm 100% sure if today the Twitter had tagged a tweet of, let's say, Kejriwal as, like, for instance, they never did it, but they never have tagged any tweet of Rahul Gandhi or Kejriwal, anybody who's saying that the Indian election process is rigged and said the facts of this are under doubt. They've never done that. They've done it to Trump. But if they had, I'm pretty sure the Indian government at that point of time wouldn't have had a problem with it, because then their Twitter would be doing exactly what it likes. It is endorsing the government stance. So again, I don't think this is a matter of principle. I think this is, again, they have tagged as manipulated something that, the official BJP spokesperson was pushing. That's the reason why all of this has happened. So it's not a question of principle. But even moving past that, it is a question of principle. In order for social media companies, they need to take a consistent stance, as I said. Either they say that we're not applicable to any country laws, we are a hypothetical entity which lives in the pipes of the internet, and so we don't answer to anyone, you can't call us, you can't subpoena us. So yeah, Mark Zuckerberg is a US citizen and stays in US, and you can only summon Mark Zuckerberg if there is a personal liability that he has, which I'm pretty sure legally he doesn't with Facebook, whenever you go public, he's just the CEO of it. So unless it's Mark Zuckerberg's traffic ticket that you're talking about, some criminal activity that Mark Zuckerberg has done, that's when you can definitely call him. But he's just a citizen for that. But in terms of Facebook, he's not answerable to the US government for any decision taken by this organization, which might be resident in the US for tax purposes, but still isn't an US organization. Now, nobody tries this line of argument, but they try this line of argument for India. It's essentially the line of argument they try. And again, what should India do? Well, again, I'm never in favor of banning somebody. And again, it comes across as a ban because these kinds of incidents happen only when Twitter does something which is against the government's interests. But this is a conversation which you don't need to have with respect to this. That's what gives it this whole banning, this gives this banning flavor. Have this conversation at a time when there's nothing going on and say, look, you have to obey with these laws. And if you feel that you cannot obey with these laws, then you cannot operate your business here. Even though I understand that, you have a whole lot of Indian users and a lot of people use your services, people love your services. But again, if you want to, and the thing is, you should be held to the same standard you're held in other countries as you're held in India. Just like you are perfectly fine with obeying the laws of other countries. And Twitter will, of course, say we want to obey the laws of every country. But technically, they don't do so. Technically, they have different standards. So they will go on Capitol Hill to appear in front of someone served by the US government for Twitter-related or Facebook-related things, not personal things of Jack or Mark. So there's a very important distinction that even these companies make with respect to the US, with respect to the EU, and with other countries. So that's the point over here. So again, in the context of what's going on, yeah, of course, the government doesn't care for privacy. It's never passed a strong privacy law. The government doesn't really care for, ultimately, the malfeasance of Facebook and Twitter. They don't really care for that. I'm not saying that they care for that. But there is a valid point. The government does have a valid point. And I wish that the BJP expressed that point in a much better way than their ambassadors on television do. They do have a point. They do have a very valid point here. But I think it comes across, and I think they are hamstrung by the fact that this is in the context of a very specific thing that adversely affects the government. So you can always spin it as the government reacting to dissent. But this, again, the ideal way was to have this conversation independent of this, and not at this time also, at a time of national crisis. Again, the thing is, well, you know, not everybody is handling the national crisis. You can chew and you can walk, you know, what's it called? You can walk and you can chew gum at the same time. But again, it's a question of optics. We are in a state of national emergency, and it just doesn't look good to be pursuing Twitter at this point of time. There will be time to do this. And this is an important thing to do. An even more important thing to do is to, you know, guarantee the data privacy and have strong laws that enforce data privacy of Indian citizens. But where is the but where is that? That is what I'm looking for. I'm looking for a GDPR kind of strong penalties for, I mean, companies make us give their data to them, whether we want to or not. We don't know. I mean, I didn't know. I mean, I'm pretty sure I've been on Air India in the last 10 years. I didn't know what kind of data of me they had collected. I'm pretty sure they have a lot of data because I paid for it. And you have to, you buy tickets under your name. So this is not data that we voluntarily gave them also. It's not like, you know, Facebook data, you don't use it. You know, this is not that data which I'm voluntarily providing. So there needs to be, and I remember in the US, what once happened was that this happened, I think, somewhere in the 2010s, that I used to work for a government agency, in the sense I was doing a research project there. So the government had my data. They did a background check on me, the US government. And then my data was compromised in one of the breaches. And at least what the US government did was they have given me from that time on, free membership in one of these identity protection services as a result. So they did something. They did some kind of, they did something at least, because I was basically forced to provide the data. It's either I get access to their government facility, and there was fairly detailed data about me, and I gave it to the US government under the trust of the US government. And, you know, somebody broke in, yes, a foreign government, everybody knows which foreign government it was, broke in and stole all that data. And so that was one of the biggest data breaches for the US federal government. And then I got an email which said, you know, your data was regrettably one of them. It was not just data about me, because they had asked data about my wife also. So they said both yours and your wife's. And so they gave us data protection, both me and my wife, and I still have that. Initially, I thought it was going to be for a few years, but it's been like more than almost 10 years now, and I still get emails from that place, and they still monitor my credit history. And this, so you know, that's that, at least something like that. When somebody loses your data, they're on the hook to make something good to you. And that's perfectly fine thing. I remember my data was in the Target breach. Target gave, you know, that service for a year or so. And again, this is where the courts get involved and say, okay, for this breach, you have to give everybody this thing for the next. It's not to just give them money. I'm not saying that. But, you know, correct the problem. At least ensure that if the data is being misused, then that person knows. And the company which is responsible for the breach pays for that. I think that's it's not a terrible thing to ask for. So again, that's the kind of legislation we need if the government is even like nominally interested in making India into a digital superpower. Because without this, without data privacy, there is no digital superpower. People ultimately are going to be afraid. I mean, my parents are dead afraid always that, you know, because they don't know cybersecurity. You know, for that generation, it's very difficult working in this digital world. And I also know that, given the fact, you know, what happens if their data gets compromised? I mean, I know, you know, I keep on changing my passwords. I use, even then my data gets, you know, keeps on getting compromised everywhere. I don't, I mean, I use alphanumeric passwords. I use like random password generators. I use, you know, password vaults. You know, I do as much as what can be reasonably done. I have two-factor authentication wherever possible. My parents can't do that. They don't know that. They don't. I mean, even when I tell them to do two-factor authentication, it's too much of trouble. I mean, of course, you know, I don't have. And I understand that. So, given that, you know, you want this generation to go digital, you have to provide them the protection. You have to give them the peace of mind that, look, at least if my data gets compromised, and my parents, my generation, they hear of this and they become more scared. For good reason too, because now they're on their own. Nobody's helping them. Nobody's even telling them actually that their data has gone. I mean, Air India, I mean, I bought tickets there. They never, I didn't, maybe somebody else did. I haven't received any notification from them that my data was stolen, but I'm pretty sure it was. I mean, many people, I don't know. I mean, I might be wrong. They might be sending emails to people, but so I can't really say, but I'm pretty sure that I've used their services for the last 10 years. Bought tickets when I was in India, flying on Air India. So I have been, at least in the US, every data breach that I have been part of, I mean, I was part of the Yahoo data breach. I mean, they sent a mail like a year later, but at least they sent it. So again, it's not that things work very well. And again, I would say in the US, the data privacy laws are, you know, not that great. The California has a fairly decent data privacy laws, but overall in the US, there is also the same kind of, you know, reason, you know, basically lobbyist sponsored reasons why there are no strong data privacy laws. But the GDPR is like an excellent example of a data privacy law that works. You know, companies are afraid of GDPR, but that's the way it should be. You know, in this day and age, you're collecting data, you're doing data mining, you're doing machine learning. That's great. That's, you know, boosting your bottom line. But you have to take the downside of it. You cannot then just walk away from it by saying, you know, what? Yeah, they just took your data. I'm sorry. You can't do that. There has to be a cost for that. So, you know, it's a risk. When you decide to keep, you know, identify data, you don't do de-identification. And that's a risk you're taking. And there needs to be a price that you have to pay for it. Again, this is what the government should be doing rather than pursuing, you know, these single incidents, which we all know are triggered by the fact that this incident has been embarrassing to the government. That's really the why they're doing it. It's not a matter of principle. Anyways, so thanks a lot for listening. And I will see you next time. So everybody do take care. Bye-bye.